You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Steve Cohen. I'm a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program, and I'm affiliated with the India Project at Brookings. Also, there's an India Project in New Delhi. Today, we're here for the launch of another book on India, but one that is exceptional and remarkable in many ways. Ambassador Schaefer, Howard and Teresita Schaefer, have written a book which is an analog to the superb book that they wrote on Pakistan, how Pakistan negotiates with the United States. They've also written other books, both together and separately. I'll say some more comments about that later. India has been emerging and rising for decades, at least since the 1970s. And I think a study of those reports over the years that examine India say that it's about to rise. And the book, the question that the Schaefer's raises is, now that it's risen and it's at the high table, what's it going to do and how will it do it? I think those are critically important questions. Some would argue that perhaps it's not worth it, that India doesn't want to be at the high table. And I guess quote Groucho Marx and say, I wouldn't want to join a club that happy as its member. But India does want to be at the high table, whatever euphemism that is, and I think we can interrogate the Schaefer's and what they mean by high table. Their bios are in the handout. We also have discussions with Ashley Tellis and Walter. Repress the name. To discuss the book, discussions also. So let me begin by asking the Schaefer's to briefly articulate the outlines of the book, the arguments, and so forth. Then we'll go directly to questions and comments.
Oh, thank you very much, Steve. Well, as Steve has said, this is the second book that we've co-drafted. The first, which I hope many of you have read, dealt with the way Pakistan conducts its foreign relations, especially the way it's negotiated over the years with the United States. We found that Islamabad's approach often included efforts to involve this country in a guilt trip. Washington, Islamabad would allege, had let Pakistan down and had failed to be a loyal ally despite all that Pakistan had done for the United States. Pakistanis were often convinced that America needed Pakistan more than Pakistan needed America. By the time we completed the book, the roller coaster-like U.S.-Pakistan relationship had gone through three marriages and two divorces, as some picturesquely put it. When we set out on that earlier enterprise, some of our friends warned us that it could lead to a third divorce, our own. We'd end up throwing ink pots at one another, or whatever co-authors toss in this computerized age. But to our pleasure, we found the experience both pleasant and stimulating, and unthreatening to our marital ties. Indeed, it whetted our appetite to try our hand at another in-depth South Asian study, this one on Indian foreign policy and diplomacy. We're delighted that you're with us today as we launch India at the Global High Table, and we're grateful for all the support we've received from Brookings and so many of you as we wrote it. India at the Global High Table is a much more complex and, I would say, more ambitious book than our Pakistan endeavor. The story we spell out in it has three parts. We survey the enduring themes that have characterized independent India's foreign policy from the Nehruvian years to those of Narendra Modi. Against this background, we consider India's vision of its global role, or more correctly, the competing visions Indians have had about that role. And we carefully examine India's negotiating style, the way its diplomats handle key issues, like those involved in the complex negotiations with the United States leading to the 2008 nuclear deal, as well as their dealings on such matters as security and commercial relations. Our examination draws heavily on the U.S.-India experience, but it also involves India's multilateral negotiations, a very important aspect of Indian diplomacy, and its negotiations with its subcontinental neighbors and China. Let me start with what we have highlighted as the three main themes of India's foreign policy: its quest for regional primacy and the security of its borders, its insistence on non-alignment, or as this has been more often termed in the post-Cold War world, strategic autonomy, and especially after 1990, its growing use of its expanding economy as a source of power on the international stage, ultimately as a springboard for India's ascent to the global high table. We look carefully at the way these themes have evolved and illustrate them in a two-chapter snapshot of Indian foreign policy, the first covering the period from independence to the 1990s, the second examining the dramatic changes that the end of the Cold War and India's almost simultaneous decision to open its economy brought about. Both periods were times of considerable flux, despite the retention of familiar shibboleths. Old definitions were often redefined. Non-alignment, often much derided in the United States and elsewhere in the West, is an example. Despite initial misgivings, Prime Minister Nehru acceded to demands from other Third World country leaders that the concept become institutionalized as the non-aligned movement. In Indira Gandhi's day, India played a leading role in reinventing the NAM by making it a key player in efforts to bring about a more equitable economic balance between the North and the South. Though she resisted Fidel Castro's call for the NAM to recognize what he argued was its natural partnership with the communist bloc. Both Nehru and his daughter were prepared to jettison non-alignment when India's security needs seemed to call for this. Nehru at the time of the 1962 border war with China, Indira on the eve of the Bangladesh War in 1971. Nowadays, non-alignment is largely viewed by Indians, except some old-timers who nostalgically persist in regarding foreign policy through a Cold War lens, as more or less synonymous with strategic autonomy. We also thought it important to examine the structure of Indian foreign policy making, especially the roles of the highly competent but undersized Ministry of External Affairs and the powerful staff of the Prime Minister's office, led by the National Security Advisor. We've looked more briefly at the Ministry of Defense, where major decisions are made not by the uniformed military brass, but by civilian Indian Administrative Service officials whose background in such matters is often very limited. We look, too, at the foreign policy-making role of Parliament, so different from the U.S. Congress, and of the Indian states, especially those with ethnic connections with neighboring countries. Finally, I should mention that we included a section on the growing role of Indian think tanks in the formation of foreign policy. Many of their brighter lights, retired officials such as the late K. Subramaniam and the late P. R. Chari, have been well known and much respected by many in this audience. We come next to the vision of India's global role that animates its policy. There is wide consensus in India about the fundamentals. Two stand out. First, that India is unique, the exemplar of a great civilization not bound by accepting what, quote, everybody does, unquote. Second, that India must above all preserve its strategic autonomy. It keeps its distance from all-encompassing international associations and especially from, quote, alliances, unquote. And India is famously a sovereignty hawk. Beyond this starting point, there are different points of view. We have distinguished among three major schools of thought. The first is the non-alignment firsters, whose view of India's role in the world was most powerfully shaped by Nehru's original concept of non-alignment. They regard India's power as driven by the force of ideas and of seizing the moral high ground. Then there are the broad power realists who stress India's relations with the world's major powers, see India as well on its way to joining that select club, regard the Indian economy as an essential source of power, and take a more utilitarian view of foreign policy. Finally, the hard power hawks. These tend to venerate India's historical arch realists, especially Kautilya, the 4th century BC Indian Machiavelli. For them, military force is the primary currency of power. One can find elements of all three in India's foreign policy, but during the post-Cold War period, policy has been closest to the broad power realist model. Prime Minister Modi comes out of the hard power hawk tradition, but has clearly grafted a strong emphasis on the economy onto the hawk's playbook. This is our backdrop for discussing India's negotiating style. And for that, I'll turn the table over to Tasey.
Thank you. And let me reiterate Howie's thanks to all of you for being here. A lot of you have been friends and colleagues for many years, not to speak of the people on this platform. I believe I first met Walter Anderson when we were both riding a bus between the State Department and the Universal North Building, where I had my first apartment in Washington. So this goes back a long way. About half of the book deals with India's negotiating style, which we have chosen to examine topic by topic and by forum. Some of our findings will be familiar to anyone who has dealt with U.S.-India official relations, the skill and sometimes stubbornness of India's negotiators, for example. Other things may be more of a surprise, or may be, as they were for us, things we recognized but had never thought about before. To whet your appetite, we've picked out a few examples that we think illustrate how India's vision of its global role has colored its negotiating approach. Let's start with India's uniqueness and with defense trade. When the U.S. sets up a defense sales relationship with anybody, part of the package includes three so-called foundational agreements. One of them embodies the U.S. legal requirement to keep track of the way U.S. supplied equipment is being used, but the others establish procedures for things like mutual logistical support between the U.S. and friendly militaries. This is a unique feature of the U.S. system. The exceptionalism that Howie talked about actually cuts both ways, and that's one of the complicating factors in U.S.-India relations. But in most cases, signing these agreements is regarded by both the U.S. and whoever the other party is as a bureaucratic housekeeping matter. But all three to India look intrusive and seem to threaten its strategic autonomy. The book describes how Hillary Clinton wrestled with this and wrestled specifically with what the U.S. refers to as end-use monitoring. And I'm sure you can all recognize how the term would make any self-respecting Indian official squirm. But I'm going to take a more recent example. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter was in India earlier this month. As he was leaving, it was announced that he and his Indian counterpart had agreed in principle on a long-postponed logistic support understanding. This understanding, they didn't actually sign it. They just agreed on what it was going to look like when there was an it to sign. And it's not actually clear that there is going to be a document to sign. I think that remains to be worked out. But it was a classic workaround. A new name, a more modest-sounding procedural understanding involving case-by-case permission, and a lot of time and heartburn. India will have its own custom-designed agreement. It won't do what, quote-unquote, everybody else does. My second example has to do with economic negotiations. Now, the minute you're negotiating on economic issues, you are dealing with domestic problems, which makes them more complicated both for India and for other countries. And in this case, my example is the United States. But the most difficult India-U.S. negotiations are multilateral. And hence, they rely critically on building coalitions. This is not an altogether comfortable exercise for Indian officials schooled in strategic autonomy. But it's one that Indians have learned how to do and do somewhat differently in each forum. India's long-running effort to avoid expanding the World Trade Organization's reach into new areas has also, however, involved important solo performances and a willingness to just say no. One example, the trade minister in the Congress government that was in power at the time used high-profile brinksmanship in 2013 to reach agreement on a package deal involving trade facilitation measures. What that means is procedures that makes the customs process not too burdensome and similar, essentially bureaucratic things, and on limits sought, the U.S. was sought on agricultural stockpiles that India wanted freedom to hold essentially as needed. The Modi government came in. That agreement was reached in December. The Modi government came in May, and within a few weeks had blocked that agreement, complaining that not enough progress had been made on its agricultural concerns. This sent shockwaves around Washington, and I think there were reciprocal shockwaves in Delhi that Washington actually cared so much. Modi's trade agreements had blocked the agreement, but this time, India had virtually no support. Everybody else was worn out by the previous Donnybrook. India, however, carried on, and it was willing to take a stand which at least one author that we looked at, wrote a fascinating book on the Mahabharata as a kind of model for India's negotiating style. I would suggest a little bit of salt in reading it, but it's a fascinating story. India was willing to take a stand reminiscent of some of the heroic figures of its ancient literature in order to make clear to both its trading partners and the voters at home that India was willing to go to the mat. Having gone to the mat, it didn't actually get much change in the agreements that it had blocked. But it certainly made a statement with impact. Third example, Howey mentioned as the first leitmotif of Indian foreign policy the pursuit of regional primacy. Add to this an acute consciousness of relative power, and you come to the heart of what is similar and different about India's negotiations with its neighbors. With Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh, India has played hardball. Not always, but it's been an important tool. In 1989, for example, to prevent Nepal from getting too close to China, India maintained a 10-month blockade of that small landlocked country. The Nepalese believe that India reenacted this unpleasant episode last winter. India has a different explanation, but there were a fair number of close observers in India who would not have disagreed with the Nepalese analysis. The hardball game, however, was not available when dealing with China. There, India faced a different problem, not just the fact that China was also a giant, because its giant status was not nearly as obvious in the early years as it has subsequently become. But for years, India had great difficulty dealing with one of the signature Chinese negotiating techniques, keeping silent on contentious issues and only engaging on an issue when it was good and ready. In those days, and I'm talking about the period up to 1962, Nehru ran foreign policy personally, and he counted on his eloquence to persuade China. He suspected that Mao's silence was an attempt to conceal problems and control timing, but he really couldn't find a good way to counter it. The China-India war that took place a couple of years after one set of border talks had broken down came as a devastating defeat for India and for Nehru personally. Eventually, the China-India border negotiations resumed and became, I would say, a more mutually hard-nosed enterprise. But it took some getting used to. Let me close with the mother of all negotiations between India and the United States, the U.S.-India Agreement on Civil Nuclear Cooperation. And here I owe a great deal to Ashley Tellis, but also to some of the counterpart negotiators in Delhi. It was an extraordinary exercise because usually when you ask people from different countries about a negotiation, there are multiple episodes where they sound like they were on different planets. And only one episode in these negotiations got that kind of treatment. This was not one negotiation, but a whole series. From the agreement in principle that George W. Bush and Manmohan Singh signed in 2005, to the statement the following year on which facilities would be covered, a unilateral Indian statement that also had to be worked out in advance with the United States, to the bilateral cooperation agreement, the so-called 123 agreement agreed on in 2007 that set the terms for U.S.-India cooperation but nearly brought down the Indian government and scuttled the accord, to the safeguards agreement negotiated between India and the IAEA, again with the U.S. in the background, to the climactic finish, the Nuclear Suppliers Group's agreement in 2008 to grant a waiver for civilian nuclear trade with India, described by one of the U.S. participants as the most brutal exercise in multilateral diplomacy he had ever seen. In this last case, only the U.S. was formally a party to the negotiations, but India's diplomacy, both bilateral and multilateral, was a critical part of the process. To get the full flavor of this negotiation and many others, you'll have to read the book. But we have two big takeaways from our research. First, never forget the importance India attaches to being handled as a unique representative of a great civilization. Many of India's tactical preferences derive from this key feature. A case in point, India's dislike for making a request when it isn't assured of a yes. And second, as we saw in the nuclear negotiations, a really strong strategic push from the top of both governments can overcome both clashes in negotiating style and disconnects between the two systems that would normally be showstoppers. In a changing world, one has to ask whether India's negotiating practices, even those that have been around since independence or longer, will change. We believe that the answer to this question will reflect two important trends. First, India's economy. Will it make another big bet on globalization as it did 25 years ago? And second, the relationships among the world's larger powers, especially the United States and China, and their ties with India. India is both drawn to and somewhat uncomfortable with the U.S. standing as the world's single most powerful country. Its response is driven, but also inhibited, by India's continuing devotion to strategic autonomy and to avoiding difficult choices. For those who say that Indians and Americans are fated to grate on each other and to suffer clashes of basic interests, I think the experience we've described shows that a more promising future is possible, not guaranteed, but possible. To get there, both sides will need to understand how the other sees them and sees the negotiating process. And we hope this book will help them do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Taser. Let me apologize to Walter K. Anderson for displacing your name, Walter, and also for not noting that Ambassadors Schaefer, plural, in addition to their distinguished experience as ambassadors in South Asia, served sequentially as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia. In other words, they were the leading policymakers for South Asia for a long stretch of time. Was that 8 years total?
I'd have to add it up.
Yeah,
something
about,
like that.
At least two terms, maybe more than that.
Seven or eight.
Yeah. So the book reflects this incredible experience as participants in the process, and also academic detachment as you look back on what happened and what may happen in the future. So let's now turn to Ashley Fellows for some additional comments.
Thank you, Steve. Let me start by congratulating Howie and Taisy for a really remarkable book. I knew the book was in the making when I first talked to Taisy many, many months, probably a few years ago. And I thought the book was going to be about India's negotiating practices. It certainly is that. But the discussion about negotiating practices is embedded in a really rich tapestry, which sort of goes way beyond the issues of negotiating practices itself. And the book is actually the better for it, because you don't see the issues of negotiating practice as somehow detached from India's inheritance, which is extremely important to keep in mind, the psychology of India's negotiators, India's policies as they have evolved over time, and the practice of Indian diplomacy as it's been manifested in all those episodes. So this is an extremely rich book, and I want to re-echo what Steve just said. It really gains not just simply from interrogating a huge literature, and there is a huge literature that both of them have read, as you can discern from the footnotes, which run into many score pages at the end of the book. But the book is filled with a great deal of nuance and a lot of telling detail, which comes essentially from being involved in the business of dealing with India. So in that sense, this is not just simply an academic book, which could have been written in a library, but is really a product of an intimate engagement with the country over many years and decades. And I promise you that reading it will be an education for anyone, including those of us who are sort of deeply and intimately involved in India. The multifaceted character of the book also makes it difficult to comment, because you can come at it from literally, a multitude of angles. And as I was thinking through what I was going to say this afternoon, I was struggling to figure out what might be a good way to summarize what I thought were key themes. And I think the best way to approach the book is to sort of compare India to previous great powers. And the point I want to make, which I think sort of captures the three derivative reflections that I'm going to offer, is that a very funny thing has happened on the way to great power status. If you look at the modernizing European states as they became great powers in the modern period, what you see is a dramatic transformation in state capacity, coupled concurrently with a remarkable improvement in societal resources. And so states become powerful just as their societies are also concurrently getting rich. And so becoming a great power had a particular kind of complexion. It was a really comprehensive effort that transformed both state and society simultaneously. The funny thing that has happened with great powers in recent years is that states are growing in capacity macroscopically, but on the edifice of still very substantial societal weaknesses. And that has a very important set of consequences for the new great powers. And I would put both China and India in this category, even though China is obviously many orders of magnitude more capable and more impressive in terms of power accumulation than India is. But this broad proposition leads me to make three points, each of these points riffing off from themes in the Schaeffer's book. The first point I want to make is that it's so clear from reading the description in the book that India is really a defensive positionalist in the international system and very conscious of the fact that it's operating in a world that has been made by others. That leads to the points that both Tazi and Howie reminded us of, which is an obsession with protecting sovereignty, a very, very concerted effort to protect independence of action, and, of course, a determination to preserve India's local primacy within South Asia itself. These are fundamentally shaped in many ways by the recognition that India lives in a world where it has to sort of defend its interests because those interests will not be defended for it. And each of these three elements, the obsession with sovereignty, the independence of action, and the desire to protect local primacy, actually poses, you know, important challenges to the United States as the United States seeks to develop a new relationship with India. For example, in principle, the U.S. is as determined to protect its sovereignty as India is. But in practice, the fact that the U.S. is a global power with global interests often ends up putting it in a position where it has to intrude on the sovereignty of others. For a country like India, which is often at the receiving end in international politics, the protection of sovereignty becomes so important because no matter how strong the relationship with the United States is, India cannot concede the principle that stronger countries have a right to intervene or abridge the sovereignty of others. The same is true for independence of action. You cannot find a country that is as determined to protect its independence of action as the United States. But again, because of the intersections between American global interests and Indian regional interests, the desire to protect the independence of action can sometimes lead to consequences that both sides neither intend nor desire. And last, of course, the question of protecting India's local primacy. In theory, the U.S. is willing to recognize India as the local primate in the South Asian region. But if that principle is taken to its extreme, which means the United States having to defer to India on the important bilateral relationships that the U.S. shares with many South Asian partners, obviously that proposition is going to create tensions in the U.S.-India relationship. You see this most clearly in the case of Pakistan and in historic times with respect to both Nepal and Sri Lanka as well. So there is a good news and there is a bad news story here when one thinks about India as a defensive positionalist. The good news is that as the United States and India evolve in their bilateral relationship, their interests converge more and more. And that makes the potential for tension between the two, it moderates the potential for tension between the two countries. But the bad news is because we come from different planets, the importance of negotiating our differences becomes critical. The automaticity of outcomes in the bilateral relationship between India and the United States simply cannot be assumed. It has to be negotiated. And that means an enormous amount of effort has to be put into getting the right outcomes as opposed to simply presuming that they will arise. There's a second broad point that comes out of the sort of governing principle of India being a new style of great power. And it's something that both Tezi and Howie flagged. India is an unyielding negotiator because it feels the imperative to protect its interests through sheer dint of effort. Unlike great powers in the past, like the United States, India does not have the resources to assure itself that the outcomes that it prefers will inevitably ensue simply as a result of having superior capabilities. So because India lacks those superior capabilities, it has to work to achieving outcomes in negotiations, often with powers that have superior capabilities relative to itself. And so it should not be surprising at one level, though if you are at the receiving end of Indian negotiation, it's not always an exciting prospect. But India is very conscious of its material weaknesses, and that sensitizes it enormously to the imperatives of avoiding losses. In fact, sometimes the importance of avoiding losses is so ingrained in the negotiating posture that Indians sometimes are willing to lose out on opportunities for greater gains if they were willing to be more flexible in their negotiating positions. And if you see, for example, India's negotiations in the WTO at Doha, it's a clear example that the desire to protect against losses prevented India from actually making modest compromises which might have had actually greater than proportionate benefits for India itself. And so the rarity of risk-taking becomes a consequence of the structural sort of impediments that India faces. The other point, which I think comes out so clearly in Howie and Tezi's book, which is worth reminding ourselves of, is something that they mentioned in the last few minutes, and that is this desire for India-specific agreements. It's obviously linked in many ways to India's uniqueness and India's perception of its own uniqueness as a civilization. But I would flag two other elements, the pressures of domestic politics that Indian politicians, the gamut that they have to run, the gauntlet that they have to run, and the pressures of democratic politics as India moves out to develop new relations with countries like the United States, close relationships that it has not enjoyed before. The importance of defending the legitimacy of those relations becomes extremely critical. And therefore, India cannot be seen as somehow joining the gang of 80 or 90 other countries that the United States may have similar relations with. So the need to show in domestic politics that these arrangements or these agreements are exclusive or preferentially beneficial to India becomes a very important part of the driving elements that shape those India-specific calculations. I would also make one other point with respect to India's bargaining strategies. The Indians drive hard bargains. It's always fun to negotiate with them because, you know, you know you're always going to be kept on your toes. But with only one exception that I can remember, once the agreements are reached, India's compliance with those agreements is generally very high. The Indians are very, very careful about upholding both the letter and the spirit of the agreement. And unlike some other countries that we negotiate with, the fears that we have to worry about non-compliance, actually matter less in the case of India compared to others. Leads me to the last thought which the book raises, which is India is now at the high table in many ways. But what kind of a power will India be as it goes forward? That, I think, is still an open question. And one can think of sort of two polarities. India could over time become like just another Western power, a power-maximizing state that seeks to transform its environment, really sort of leave its impress on the environment in which it is located. Somehow, reading Tezi and Howie's book, I do not get the impression of India as a relentless power maximizer, at least outside of South Asia. Inside South Asia, of course, its natural hegemony gives it much more flexibility and a greater desire to sort of shape the choices made by its smaller neighbors. But outside South Asia, I see India still being very much in the struggle to adjust and shape its environment. And so I think India is, of course, in that evolutionary phase where it is coming to terms with its own growth and capacity. And over a period of time, it could be much more forthright and much more willful in how it exercises its power. But for the foreseeable future, much of what is in Tezi's book leaves me with the impression that India is still going to be a relatively conservative power on the international stage. In terms of the classical distinctions in international relations theory, it will persist as a leading power, one that will make an impact in shaping its environment, rather than as a true great power, which is a state that actually determines the environment in ways that affect both itself and others. So once again, let me just end by commending the book for your reading. And even if you are a longtime student of India, there is much that you will learn from it, as I did in reading it. Thank you very much.
Before I ask Walter to offer a few remarks and have the Schaeffers respond, I must ask, Ashley, what's the exception to the Indian good behavior in agreements?
I think the one that comes closest in my mind was the use of fuel from the Cirrus reactor for the 74 test.
Walter, do you want to...
Yeah, thank you. Tacy had mentioned that we first met 46 years ago on a bus, and I've been friends with them ever since, and I've learned a great deal from them, and I've read some of their books in the making, and pleased to do so. I've actually assigned their book to one of my classes next year at SCI, so I can guarantee about 15 to 20 copies will be sold. I hope that's encouragement elsewhere for those of you who teach, that if you have anything to do with South Asia, you take a look at their book. I think the very special feature of this book that you don't see elsewhere is it fills a gap of analysis in Indian's foreign policy, and specifically the reporting of India's approach to multilateral and bilateral negotiations. And hopefully it will encourage other people to write in these areas. Now, admittedly, the Schaeffers are uniquely qualified to do so. Both of them have spent most of their career either in South Asia or on South Asia. And my many years at the State Department, South Asia, to a certain extent, met the Schaeffers, one or the other, to whom I often went for advice or help. The book, as they say at the beginning, is a labor of love. And it certainly is, and that's reflected in the meticulous detail that one finds in a book that is, for the complexity of the book, remarkably easy to read, well-written and interesting. Now, on the substance of the book, there are a few things I want to say. The Schaeffers address the question of whether India is sufficiently daring to assume a leadership role in a changing world. In short, can India get past transactional relations with individual countries and pursue a strategic vision at the global high table? Now, as I read the book, and I think Ashley is reading it in the same way for judging from his remarks, I think the answer is maybe. Not necessarily. It depends how things go. They list four drivers in foreign policy: exceptionalism, supremacy in South Asia, non-alignment, and a desire for economic power. I agree with them that the most difficult on the issue of leadership is likely to be non-alignment. And unless India seriously engages in a review of this driver of its foreign policy, it's likely to end up with transactional relations with each of the major powers at the expense of a larger global vision. But there is a fifth driver, and Ashley related to that fifth driver near the end of his comments, that is an equally daunting challenge to India's quest for leadership, and that is domestic politics. And I use that term in the broad sense of decision-making at home. A new approach on foreign policy will almost certainly meet resistance because it impacts on many interests and a traditional way of doing business. Manoj Joshi, I read an article, you may have read his article too, on the Ashton Carter visit, in which he says India is giving up its independence of judgment to the U.S. That reflects a deeply held view in among Indians who comment on foreign policy. Mobilizing support for changes requires, in my view, a large measure of political stability at home. And whether this is possible as you look out into the future is not at all certain, given the fragmented nature of Indian politics and the weakness of the ruling BJP in many parts of the country. While the BJP has a majority today in India's lower house of parliament, the return of coalition politics at the next parliamentary election in 2019 is a real possibility, and the imperative of coalition politics may mean that foreign policy decisions will be driven by the parochial interests of regional political parties, as several important relations with India have demonstrated in the past, namely with Bangladesh, but there are others as well. Still another element of domestic political process is the ability to sustain the desired high level of growth that the Schaeffers mentioned and others do too is essential for India to be a great power. And normally governments of India have said 7 to 8% plus is necessary. However, that goal faces the political reality of a country that is still largely poor and a country historically committed to political equity. And so far, the Modi government has been hesitant to take the often painful adjustments necessary for long-term and rapid economic growth. The last two budgets reflect this caution. The unmet needs of India's poor and huge infrastructure needs also means that the guns and butter debate is likely to be resolved in the favor of butter in the Indian context. A related point is whether the Indian political class is prepared to accept the important role of private investment at home and in mobilizing outside support for investment in India. That investment by private enterprise, both Indian and foreign, is a strategic shift in the way Prime Minister Modi embarks on his major Make in India campaign, with a focus on defense manufacturing, much of it by private enterprise. Already, much of the Indian political class, as the my mention of Manoj Joshi indicates, has charged him with selling out to the U.S. and abandoning India's commitment to strategic autonomy. Yet India faces several major challenges that require leadership on its part. One is a rising China that is both much richer and militarily stronger, and with an interest in deepening relations with its South Asian neighbors and around the Indian Ocean. Another is a terrorist threat from the northwest of the subcontinent. A third is greater integration in the world economy. And fourth is looming environmental disasters in South Asia and elsewhere. So what will it take to move India into a leadership position? And I want to make a few quotations from a speech that Indian Foreign Affairs Secretary S. Jaishankar gave at the April 6, 2016 inauguration of the Indian Center of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he addressed this role. And you, I'm sure, were there when he gave the talk. It's a fascinating talk. If you haven't seen it, I strongly encourage you to read it. He starts the talk with a categorical statement that, and I quote here, "The quest towards becoming a leading power rests first and foremost on our success in expanding the economy," a point the Schaeffers also make. He goes on to say that making India a world leader will be a priority goal for Indian diplomats, and perhaps with an eye on his own bureaucracy, asserts, and I quote, "This task calls for change in attitude and skills of diplomats, which I can affirm," he says, "is already underway." I'm sorry I missed the facial expression on that, but I'm sure it was intent when he made that.
It's on the web.
And it's also on the web. He then says that India's immediate goal is, of course, being linked more closely to South Asia. But he goes on to say, and I quote, "An aspiring leading power, at a minimum, needs to expand its global footprint far beyond the region. And he specifically mentions the U.S., Russia, EU, Japan, and China. He then goes on to say, and I quote, "An important characteristic of a power that seeks to go beyond a limited agenda is interest in global issues. In short, moving beyond mere transactional relations." Jaishankar can raise these questions because Prime Minister Modi is willing to think differently about India and how the world interacts with it. The real question, however, is how deep and sustainable are Modi's views? And will he sustain the attacks by liberals on the left who put ideology above self-interest and the nativist right that has little appreciation for the larger world and is easily influenced by xenophobia? I strongly agree with the Schaeffer's closing argument at the very end of the book, the very last paragraph, as does Jaishankar, by the way, that if India is to assume the role of a leader in international affairs, its policies must become more deeply interdependent with those of other countries. The hard part is getting there.
Would you like to comment?
Go ahead.
Discuss the question.
I would like to hear from the people who have been sitting patiently, but let me just make two comments in response to what we've just heard. Ashley said that with one exception, and he mentioned the nuclear fuel issue, India fulfilled the agreements that it reached. I would say that there's another example, although it's really an example of the complexity of a system where the federal government can decide some things, state governments can decide some things, and when you have a mismatch between the two, anything can happen. And that is the electric power plant at Dabhol, which was an Enron brainchild and which, I mean, the international role in which eventually collapsed. And there are any number of case studies on this coming out of business schools and in legal journals and so on. We've done a very selective look at that, but I think there's enough in the book to back up the point that I've just made. The second point, Walter argued that in order to mobilize support for real changes in Indian foreign policy, you need to have political stability, and the coalition governments, he implied, can't do it. I don't altogether agree, because I think the post-Cold War changes in Indian foreign policy were, for the most part, taken by and sustained by coalition governments. But then that gets into the difference between a stable coalition and an unstable coalition, and the Indians have plenty of experience with both.
Before we turn to the audience for some comments and questions, let me make a few remarks myself. Since we're reminiscing, I first met Ambassador Howard Schaeffer in 1965 when he was in the Indian Embassy, and Howie was the first American diplomat I ever met. It was quite a lesson.
It was a very interesting experience. Yeah. We found ourselves together at the annual meeting of the Indian National Congress, which took place in a small town in West Bengal. The main subject of that discussion, I think it was in 64, was should India go nuclear, build a nuclear bomb following Chinese explosions. Who do you suppose was the leading voice speaking out against such a proposal? It was Krishna Menon.
Wow.
Yeah. Let me make a few comments of my own, probably building on what Ashley said. I've always regarded India as a revolutionary country in that they're attempting at the same time to transform the relationship between the center and the states, which is where a lot of the coalitions come from. They're attempting to make a new foreign policy, casting aside the British model. They create a new non-aligned foreign policy, which is being adopted. They're also attempting to overturn the caste system. And there have been recent events which have brought that to publicity recently. And the caste system is still alive and strong in India. And furthermore, attempting to revolutionize India's class system. That's what economic growth is about. And finally, all of this requires an economic revolution, which is so India, in overall, I would regard it as a revolutionary state. I made that argument in my own book, India Emerging Power. So it's a revolutionary state, and they're conducting these revolutions under a condition of democratic governance, which is an amazing event. I think that itself commands our attention, and our respect at the same time. So I think we can now turn to the audience. Many people out here know the Schaefer as well, for questions and comments. David Sedney, back there. David?
Thanks, and I apologize. I've not read the book, so I can't comment on that. But on the discussion and on the issue of India at the high table, I'm not at all an India expert. I spent most of my career on China. But the countries that I think can legitimately be said to be at the high table have an additional characteristic beyond military power, economic power, and civilization, old or new, that deserves respect. And that's an ideology. That's a motivating, attractive principle to others, at least they think is attractive. China has what people call the Beijing Consensus, a very different view of the economic, social, and political order that it offers to other countries, as the Chinese today say, is a better model than the individual-oriented U.S. approach or the more social approach of Western Europe. Am I missing something here? Does India have an ideology that can be attractive to others? Because as what you've laid out basically seems negative, non-aligned, autonomy, things that are not an ideology but a position. So perhaps I'm wrong that in order to be really at the high table, you need an ideology that is attractive to others, that offers them a vision for their future. And perhaps I'm wrong that India doesn't have one, but I'd love to hear your comments.
I'm not sure I agree with your premise that you need an ideology that will attract others in order to be at the high table. And Steve started out by wondering what that meant, the high table. An Indian friend of mine said that what India wanted to be a member of the board of the world. And I think that's basically what we had in mind.
Another way of looking at it is that Indians prefer a multipolar world. They would see themselves as one of the poles.
But the ideological attraction is more important if you expect to have sort of an automatic group of countries that will follow in your wake, and that certainly has been important for the United States. Europe, I think you'd have to make a rather more complicated argument. Japan, no, at least not now. World War II, yes, certainly. China, yes. So there's a mixed result. If you wanted to look at the way Indians look at the world and at their own society and find elements of an ideology, there are certainly pieces of it that you could find. And if you go back to the early years, there's a lot of idealism there. Nehru's dream of a resurgent Asia with India and China leading the way got blasted to bits in 1962. But there are elements of it that still pop up from time to time. But it's hard to fit India into that mold, basically.
Could I add something? I think there are two possible answers to that as you compare India with China. It has always struck me that, you know, if you have an ideology in the sense that you were referring to Chinese ideology, it's the democratic process in India. It's a kind of ideology, looking at the world and how India should function. Where that came into debate was the 1975 state of emergency in India, which in effect dumped democracy for a while. There was a very adverse reaction to that activity. And I don't think anyone today in India could propose seriously moving away from the democratic model in the country. The other aspect has to do with the civilizational aspect. There is a strong sense in India that they are a unique and distinct civilization. The group I look at most closely, the Hindu nationalists, have a very strong sense of what it is to be Indian, but others do as well. Read Nehru's Discovery of India, where he then discovers this great civilization out there and what it offers in bringing us all together.
A few pages worth of cliff notes in the first chapter.
Yes.
I think another point is that over the years, whichever government has been in Delhi, India has not tried to export democracy. You don't get anything like this America's effort, the effort of American political parties to set up offices to promote democracy and democratic practices. If a country wants India's help, say, in organizing the minutiae of an election, India will provide that. But the idea of India holding forth as a beacon of democracy and calling on other countries to follow suit, you have never seen that.
There is no Indian equivalent of the Confucian Institutes around the world to advocate a certain ideology.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I, as an Indian, I would like to say the organizing principle of the idea called India is unity in diversity. I think a lot of the approaches India has taken to the world, we can move towards that. I think my interest is what India is today is what America is becoming. This idea of unity and diversity, if it can work in an impoverished country like India, there is hope for the world.
That is what I would call a beer and pizza question, one that one can discuss much better with beer and pizza, tea and samosas,
right,
and preferably late at night.
This gentleman right here.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. I also worked in the Universal North building, as one of the panelists did. I'm Elliot Hurwitz, a former State Department official under Secretary Wiles and Secretary Shultz in the 1980s. And I believe Mr. Schaefer made the comment that Modi is a hawk. And I would like to ask the question, who is the adversary if he is a hawk?
First of all, you can be a hawk based on the concept of adversaries. Secondly, I think that Pakistan is certainly an adversary, although most Indian strategic analysts nowadays would argue that China is India's most important strategic challenge and that Pakistan is not in that same league. You can argue that for some purposes China is the adversary, but China is simultaneously a country with which India has very important economic relations. And Modi is, you know, if the concept of sovereignty hawk has any meaning, he's one of them.
I would argue a P.S. unless Ashley wants to comment on that. Do you?
No.
That adversaries are a product of the nation state. You define yourself by who you're not and who opposes you. And in a sense, if you look around the world, everybody says that they live in a dangerous neighborhood, including all their neighbors. So in other words, the world is defined by a sense of fear and danger everywhere, so whether it's Asia, Latin America, certainly the Middle East. So I don't think the question is terribly relevant. Who India defines as? They will find an enemy somewhere. Indira Gandhi defined the Americans as an enemy, a U.S., China, Pakistan axis. So I think that's a question for which there are many answers. Nilanthi?
Thank you, and congratulations on the book. My question is about India's policy toward the neighborhood. Tezi, you mentioned how India has played hardball in Nepal, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. And Ashley, you mentioned how India is not a power maximizer outside South Asia, with smaller South Asia being the exception. I'm wondering, as India continues its ascent to the global high table, will we see a lessening of this tendency in the neighborhood, or is this just simply unrelated as a dimension? Is this just a timeless aspect of Indian foreign policy?
I'm encouraged to believe that India has now set off on a good neighbor policy, which has a very interesting and I think new aspect. And that is, in the past, India has preferred, because it's by far the most powerful country in South Asia, to negotiate with the smaller countries on a one-on-one basis. It can be very tough. It has been very tough in such negotiations. It's now changed its tune, at least with regard to Bhutan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. The record with Nepal is ambiguous. The record with Pakistan is bad. But the idea now is that India is prepared to enter into multilateral negotiations, at least to begin with, on economic issues. And this, I know, has been welcomed by these smaller countries, which feel that they'll be in a better bargaining position.
Can I take a crack at that? I think there are several dimensions to the question. It's very clear that there is a huge gap in material capabilities between India and its neighbors. What has always been lacking, though, from an Indian perspective, is consent to Indian primacy. And so it's almost Gramscian in some sense. You're powerful, but it's not enough to be powerful. You need acknowledgement of your power. And so that's one important element. The second element has to do with a very strong Indian conviction that all of South Asia has a sort of unity, however defined, and that the processes of politics over centuries have fragmented that unity. And so there is a struggle to reunify the South Asian space. The question is what means you use to do it. If the means are classical international relations politics, you are never going to get that unity because it's going to be competition, contestation, resistance. And so the opportunity that India now has is to see whether it can recast that unity on the basis of economics, whether economic integration helps unify the subcontinent and take the edge of some of the political rivalries that would naturally occur if India sought consent purely in political terms.
Yes, this woman right here. Could you state your name, please?
Yes, I'm Lauren Holt, formerly with State Department. My question is about India potentially joining APEC and with an eye on TPP. Asia Society recently put out a report. The Indian ambassador to the U.S. was speaking glowingly about their interest in that. Looking at some of the ideas that you've mentioned, how do you place that?
Actually, I just got back about 10 days ago from 10 days in India, during much of which time I was talking about that very issue, not making speeches about, but listening. I think you got two conflicting tendencies here. On the one hand, there is a strain of thought in India that joining, preferably in a prominent position, various international clubs is a good thing for India. And, of course, prime among those is the UN Security Council with a permanent seat. On the other hand, there is another school of thought that says you don't want to, that when you join clubs of this sort in a prominent position, you wind up having to say stuff that's guaranteed to irritate somebody you don't want to irritate. And I remember vividly the then Indian ambassador who was sitting in the audience when a former Indian ambassador opined that the Security Council really wasn't a particularly big deal for India. And she stood up and said, it's extremely important. And I thought, boy, we've We got them both in the room. APEC isn't quite in that league. India's interest in APEC stems from, first of all, its greater interest in East Asia, which has been a factor since the mid-1980s. Secondly, its more successful economy, which has led, among other things, to its negotiating a free trade area with ASEAN. U.S. trade officials sneer at the free trade area because its coverage isn't nearly as wide as a comparable U.S. agreement. But for India, this was a big deal. The U.S. has been, I would say, cool to Chile on the prospect of India joining APEC until President Obama and Prime Minister Modi discussed it, at which point President Obama said that we welcome India's interest in joining APEC, and I would describe that as a lawyerized statement. In other words, look for fine print all over the place. But largely at U.S. instigation, APEC instituted a moratorium on new members, so India has been, in very classic fashion, reluctant to ask again until it was sure the answer was going to be yes. In the wake of the Obama statement, and with India's economic performance still pretty strong, the issue of APEC has come up again. But what we found, and we in this case was a group put together by the U.S.-India Business Council, was that, first of all, the Indian government and the Indian political system are extremely skittish about any further trade opening at the present time. And this is, in part at least, driven by the small trader constituency that's always been a very important part of Modi's base. And that there was at least one group that saw APEC as the camel's nose under the tent. APEC doesn't have any binding agreements, so that it shouldn't be threatening. But there are those in the Indian government that thinks that would make it a great way to start, and there are others that think that would make it a dangerous way to start because you couldn't stop. And it was pretty apparent as we went around and talked to people both inside and outside of the government that this tug of war had not been resolved. I wouldn't be surprised to see them move on that sometime soon, and there's a growing consciousness in India that if the TPP, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership goes through, India will suffer most undesirable competition in its export markets. And again, you got two kinds of answers. One, on the one hand, a lot of observers were saying the Vietnamese are going to eat our lunch. And others were saying, well, we'll figure out a way. This is what I referred to as India's preference for avoiding difficult choices. But sometimes avoiding a choice is a choice. So this is a rather long answer to a nice, clear question, but I hope it helps you.
Yes, gentleman in the center. Could you state your name, please?
Yeah, my name is Anil Sigdel. I have a PhD from the University of Vienna, Austria, in political science. Good. I come from Nepal. I'm a resident of this beautiful town of Washington, D.C. My question is addressed to Madam Schaefer. It probably would be relevant to Sir Ashley as well, but questions I have many, but because of the time constraint, I just have one question. It is about the U.S. policy, especially in terms of the relationship between India and the small, they are not really small, but compared to India's small neighbors. Is it true that there was a claim, if you remember, at the time of the end of the Maoist insurgency in Nepal, when everybody went against King Gyanendra Saha, there was a talk in town that the United States outsourced its Nepal policy to India? So as a Nepali citizen and a student of political science, what should I expect in the days ahead where the United States sees in the region itself, especially in terms of the relationship between India and a small labor, especially in the changing context, right? Even India has always claimed, still claiming its hegemony or the local primacy. It's certainly changing. In fact, we would call it it's losing the ground there. There are a lot of recent evidence what's going on in Maldives, relationship between India and Maldives, what recently happened in Nepal. It was the third time that India imposed, but they say it's not declared a blockade, but it's a third economic and trade blockades. And in fact, it sort of backlashed because first time in the history of Nepal, now we have a trade agreement with China, the only second country after India. So what, Madam Schaefer, thank you.
I can certainly understand your anxiety about the fallout from problems between India and Nepal. This has always been a difficult area. India has, as I said, played hardball. The United States has certainly in the past 25 years come to consult more closely with India about policies in the South Asian region. That, frankly, is something that Nepal and everybody else ought to welcome, because if you have missed communications and missed cues between the United States and India, it's likely to end badly for everyone. If your expectation is that U.S. sympathy for a tough spot that Nepal may find it in is going to result in either military intervention or some kind of a magic wand, I think you will be disappointed. The U.S. does not outsource its policy to India, but it treads carefully when it's working in the periphery of a friendly country with whom we have overlapping but not identical interests. And I think it's likely to stay complicated.
I would just make one point. When you think about issues like this, they're not always purely interstate issues. I mean, in the most recent problem between India and Nepal, it was what was implicated was an internal disagreement between within Nepalese society and India's interests in creating a certain outcome there. So you've got to take into account the fact that there are internal dissensions in each of these states, which then bleed into the interstate relationship. The point that Tezi made, I think, is the one that you have to always keep in mind. The U.S. is always going to ask itself what its interests and what its stakes are in any of these countries. And if those stakes, important though they may be, do not warrant overriding the relationship that it has with a very powerful neighbor like India, the U.S. is simply going to be much more deferential to Indian interests in a situation like this. Now, this varies from country to country, circumstance to circumstance. But, you know, you don't want to take the logic of sovereign equality too seriously when you are dealing with countries of such asymmetrical size and when the interests are so different.
Yes, this gentleman over here.
Hi, Dave Ramaswamy. A couple of comments and a question. The name for India in ancient China was Tianzu, which is the pillar of heaven. And the Chinese diplomat Hu Xi made a statement that India dominated China for 20 centuries without sending a single soldier across the border. Angus Madison, the economic historian, has shown that India was the world's biggest economy for 1600 of the last 2,000 years. And also, India is the only country with an ocean named after it, because historically there was a Pax Indica ranging from East Africa to modern-day Bali. So knowing these facts, you know, of course, Prime Minister Nehru gave up the seat on the Security Council, which is offered to India, to China. And since then, India has almost been in the South Asian high chair. So going forward, how can the U.S. work together with India for force projection and maintaining security in the Indian Ocean rim states and ultimately bringing India to a G3 kind of scenario along with China and itself? Thank you.
I'm going to focus on the last part of your question because the 2,000-year historical perspective, I think, would require a lot of tea and samosas or beer and pizza. I think that David Sedmi will bear me out that if the United States raised with its, the U.S. defense officials raised with their Indian counterparts, how can we do force projection together, you would get a lot of Indian officials running, screaming in the other direction. I don't think that is on the U.S.-India agenda at the moment. What we seem to be working on, and bear in mind that I've been out of government for almost 20 years now, is a very different kind of strategic conversation. It took a while before the strategic dialogue between the United States and India reached the point where it even deserved that name, where countries were talking about what their broader strategic goals were. I think we have reached that point. Our defense trade has also come to include some fairly important items. And as I indicated, Ashton Carter looks like he's finally going to get one of the agreements that normally accompany that, but that is for all kinds of reasons difficult for the Indians to fit into their system and to the way they look at the world and their strategic autonomy. From the perspective of what you're asking about, though, the most interesting development is the Indian Ocean Naval Summit, which was begun with Indian leadership a few years back, which initially was limited to countries that border on the Indian Ocean, and that would include those that border on the Arabian Sea, so that Arabians collectively have a body of water named after them, even if it isn't called an ocean. And I believe the U.S. is now an observer in this. What exactly its role is a little bit unclear to me, but it certainly includes bringing people into the conversation about security in that region. Some years back, the U.S. Navy issued a policy statement, the burden of which was we are still a two-ocean navy, but now the oceans in question are Pacific and Indian, so that the whole question of Indian Ocean security has become a more consequential one for U.S. strategists. I think you see a movement closer together. We also have at the diplomatic level a very serious dialogue between India and the United States, and this is the State Department and the Ministry of External Affairs. Amusing aside note, Howie and I went and called on the Indian Joint Secretary for East Asia a couple of years back to interview him for the book. And as we sat talking, we happened to notice on an end table in his office a baseball bat. This is a pretty unusual prop in the Ministry of External Affairs. So when we came to a break in the conversation, it's a very bright guy, Gautam Bambawale, he's now ambassador in Pakistan, high commissioner in Pakistan. We said, where did the baseball bat come from? Oh, he said, the first time we met with our American counterparts, Kurt Campbell came equipped, that was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, came equipped with a cricket bat and a baseball bat. And the Indian team signed the cricket bat, which he kept in his office, and I kept the baseball bat with the American signatures. A nice, slightly hokey, theatrical touch, but it did capture the spirit of things. That is what helps you to get to first base, which you can only do in baseball and not in cricket, in terms of developing a broader strategic conversation. At this point, we're a long way from thinking about joint force projection. The closest we've come to it is joint disaster relief work, which actually was a light bulb moment for the Indians who participated in it. And as far as G3 is concerned, I think you'd have both the American and the Indian participants in the room having a sudden need to go someplace else if that subject came up.
Sir, let me, as a historian, let me comment on, obviously, you're versed in history, let me comment, say a few words. There are three events that took place, 1945-2 and 1947-1. 1945, this response to some of David Sedney's comments, the United States defeated China's only real enemy, which was Japan. We wiped them off as a major power, and they've remained a non-power ever since, economic superpower, but not a military power. In 1945 also, we dropped an atomic bomb on Japan, which contributed to the end of the war, which then transformed relations between any states that had them. India, Pakistan, China, the U.S. all have nuclear weapons. Any rational calculation leads you to conclude very quickly that a major war between any of these states can't happen. Well, even President Reagan said that. Cannot happen, should not happen. So I think that the balance of power game that's played, use of military power, really was still catching up to reality, especially in Asia. Especially the Indians who want to be a great nuclear power, but I don't think really want to be a great nuclear power. For them, it's for Superman, among others, it was a symbolic act, not a military act. So I think you have to rethink your cotillion and your rule of power and become a great state. The relevant model may be Europe, which is a civilian superpower, has no serious military power, but has great economic power and a cultural power which spreads around the world. Let me be back on your... Yes, sir, over there. Yeah. Gentleman over here.
Greg Tillman, Arms Control Association. This may be an elaboration for the last remarks made, but I'm wondering if the panelists could comment on what really drives Indian nuclear weapons policy. Is it perceived as a ticket to the global high table, or is it a specific response to nuclear threats perceived from China, for example?
Ashley, I think you're the one up here who's best qualified to answer that.
Nothing I say, Greg, will come as a surprise to you. I think it has three elements, I guess. One is, as long as there is a natural connection between great power status and nuclear weaponry, the elements of prestige will always sort of be there in the background. But I think there are two other issues which are more active in terms of... First is Pakistan. And very consciously in the Indian mind is the reality of Chinese nuclear assistance. The rise of Pakistan as a nuclear power because of China and all the implications that has for Indian threat perception vis-a-vis China. The second is the desire to maintain some kind of a minimal deterrent force against the Chinese because of the various sort of dimensions of competition. So there is clearly a security dimension in addition to the status dimension. The good news, I think, in all of this is India does not see having a large arsenal as being the necessary predicate for being at the global high table. And so you can imagine an Indian nuclear program that is still relatively small and relatively limited and satisfying both its security and its status needs with the economic issues really determining whether it's finally persists at the high table or not.
We just have a few minutes more, so let's try and group questions. This gentleman here and that gentleman there.
Hi there. I just picked up a copy of your book and scrolled through the back of the index to see if there was anything on Afghanistan. So I'm looking forward to read that. So my question regarding Afghanistan kind of goes back to what Mr. Tellis said. You've seen Afghanistan, India become a little more involved in with state building efforts in Afghanistan, especially with them building the parliament. Is that a sign that India is coming out of its conservative streak of playing a huge role in world affairs? And secondly, a lot of scholars have written that India-U.S. relations can be summed up in this statement, that it's a mix of ideals and interest. And some even go so far as to say that they'll never be allies. What would you think of what are your thoughts on that statement? Thank you.
Well, addressing your first question, it seems to me that India is not trying to expand its role in Afghanistan. That India's position continues to be that it will provide as much support as it can for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, for the economy of Afghanistan, for social work. But it does not wish to get involved in any significant political way in in Afghanistan. It has been prepared to train some troops, some Afghan troops, for service in the war in Afghanistan. But I think it recognizes the dangers for India becoming further involved, and questions how successful any political role could be for India.
I think that just about does it for time. Let me pick up an answer I gave, which was incomplete. I said there were three historic dates that were important. 45, because Japan was destroyed as a rival to China, nuclear weapons used. The third event was 1947, when the British left South Asia, partitioning a major power that had been created by the Mughals, and then not by the Hindus, but by the Mughals, and developed themselves into the Raj. And that created two rival states, India and Pakistan. Now, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. So I think the region's dilemma is that there are two countries which aspire not to greatness, one to greatness and the other to balancing, India and Pakistan. And my own view is that as long as this is going to go on indefinitely, and that's one of India's chronic problems, how to deal with Pakistan. Let me thank the authors, the commentators, the audience for a splendid session.
Thank you.